WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show?
Listening to WGXC Acra. What up, Hudson Catskill? 90.7 FM.
There are all sorts of creative community voices on the radio on Wednesday, March 2nd, including at 10 a.m. The Synth Eclectico show is on with tracks from Alejandra Cardenas, Stefan Goldman, Gabriela Calzada, and others. Then at 11 a.m., it's time for Mirage Station, the new show from Mayuko Fujino. It's live from the WGXC Acra studio. Then we go live to Catskill after the new news to Spike's Record Rack, where Spike Priggen broadcasts the Bedazzled Radio Hour for 2 hours until 2 p.m. with all sorts of rock, pop, and more. At 4 p.m., we are live from the WGXC Hudson studio with the WGXC Afternoon Show with Vern Cross, Jaden Cross, India Cross, Kamal Johnson, Ed Mack, and others. At 7 p.m., we're live from New York City with the Off the Hook Show, simulcast from WBAI. It's from the 2600 Hacker Collective, and it's all about technology and more. Then at 8 p.m., we're live from Hudson with Rock and Roll High School with Peter McPartland and Anya Kanovskaya. At 10 p.m., we're live from Ulster County with Jeff Economy and Snack Point Charlie, and then we stay in Ulster County for 2 more hours of live radio with Peter Aaron and his Go-Go Kitty show at midnight, simulcast from Radio Kingston in Ulster County and on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at WGXC.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to Ginger Radio Hour. This is Justin Maiman. I'm live inside WGXC's Acra studio. Again, you're listening to 90.7 FM, and today we have a wonderful, wonderful show. In a bit, I'm going to play my conversation with Gary Steingart, the Hudson Valley-based writer. Has a new book. It's called Our Country Friends, which is also set up here during the pandemic. It's a serious and very funny pandemic novel. And it turns out Gary says he gets all his best writing done up here in the Hudson Valley. So, I'm going to play that interview in a bit. Of course, I'm going to play lots of music today, especially, and first, some music to set the mood. So here we go.
Now you can look the word up again and again, but the dictionary doesn't know the meaning of friends. And if you ask me, you know I couldn't be much help, because a friend's somebody you judge for yourself. Some are okay and they treat you real cool, and some mistake your kindness for being a fool. We like to be with some because they're funny. Others come around when they need some money. Some you grew up with around the way, and you're still real close to this very day. Homeboys through the summer, winter, spring, and fall. And then there's some we wish we never knew at all. And this list goes on again and again. But these are the people that we call friends. Out together, we barely knew each other. We had no intentions on becoming lovers, but in no time at all, you became my girl. Me and you, one-on-one against the world. Talking on the telephone for hours at a time, or else I was at your house or you was at mine. And then came the arguments and all kinds of problems. Besides making love, we had nothing in common. It could have lasted longer because it started out strong, but I guess we went about the whole thing wrong. Because out of nowhere, it just came to an end, because we became lovers before we were friends.
Friends, how many of us have them? Friends, ones we can depend on. Friends, how many of us have them? Friends, before we go any further, let's be friends.
They say you and the girlfriend were so tight. You took her out with you and your guy one night. She even had a set of keys to your home, and you shared mostly everything you own. But as she shook your hand, she stole your man, and it was done so sweet, it had to be a plan. Couldn't trust her with cheese, let alone your keys. With friends like that, you don't need enemies. You wonder how long it was all going on, and you're still not sure if your glad is gone. You say, well, if she took him, he was never mine. But deep inside, you know that's just another lie. And now you're kind of cold towards people you meet, cause of something that was done to you by some creep. But nevertheless, I'll say it again, that these are the people that we call friends.
Friends, how many of us have them? Friends, before we go any further, let's be friends. We'll be right back.
real friends? How many of us? How many of us? How many jealous? Real friends, there's not many of us. We smile at each other, but how many honest? Trust issues, switch up the number. I can't be bothered, I cannot blame you for having an angle. I ain't got no issues, I'm just doing my thing. Hope you're doing your thing too. I'm a deadbeat cousin, I hate family reunions. The church up by drinking at the communion, spilling free wine, now my tux is ruined. In town for a date, what the f*** we doing? Who your real friends? We all came from the bottom. I'm always blaming you, but what's sad, you not the problem. Damn, I forgot to call him. I thought it was Thursday. Why you wait a week to call my phone in the first place? When was the last time I remembered a birthday? When was the last time I wasn't in a hurry? Tell me you want them tickets when it's game time. Even to call your daughter on a FaceTime. Even when we was young, I used to make time. Now we be way too busy just to make time. Even for my real friends, I guess I get what I deserve, don't I? Word on the streets is they ain't heard from them. I guess I get what I deserve, don't I? Talk down on my name, throw dirt on them. I couldn't tell you how old your daughter was. Couldn't tell you how old your son is. I got my own junior on the way, dog. Plus I already got one kid. Couldn't tell you much about the fam, dog. I just showed up for the games, dog. Maybe 15 minutes, took some pictures with your sister. Merry Christmas, then I'm finished. Then it's back to business. You wanna ask some questions about some real shit? Like I ain't got enough pressure to deal with. Please don't pressure me with that bills. Cause everybody got them that ain't children. Oh, you been nothing but a friend to me. Nick thinking I'm crazy, you defending me. It's funny, I ain't spoke to niggas in centuries. To be honest, dog, I ain't feeling your energy. Money turn your kin into an enemy. Niggas ain't villains, they pretend to be. Looking for real friends.
Real friends.
How many of us? How many of us are real friends? To real friends, to the real end. To the reals,
fall off.
To the wheels don't spin.
Yeah, yeah.
To 3 a.m. calling. How many
real friends?
Just to ask you a question, just to see how you was feeling. How many? For the last, you was frontin'. I hate when they text you like, what's up, fam? Hope you good. You say, I'm good, I'm great. The next text, they ask you for something. How many?
What's best for your family, immediate or extended? Any argument, the media extended.
I had a cousin that stole my laptop that I was fucking bitches on. Pay that nigga $250,000 just to get it from him. Real friends. Yeah. Real friends. I guess I get what I deserve, don't I? Word on the streets is they ain't heard from them. I guess I get what I deserve, don't I? Talk down on my name, throw dirt on them.
Kanye West, Real Friends. Before that, Houdini with Friends. We're building to something here, I think you can see. Next up, the Boston Typewriter Orchestra to get us ready for Gary's interview. I had the pleasure of seeing them at the Greenville Drive-In last summer with my friend Jim. I definitely encourage you to see just once, or maybe more, the Boston Typewriter Orchestra live. So Gary Steingart and I met up last week to have a conversation. He has a brand new book. It's called Our Country Friends. I'm going to play a selection here. He very kindly agreed to read from the beginning of the book. I'm going to play that here in one moment. But I want to give you a quick heads up about what the book's all about. 8 friends, 1 country house, 4 romances, and 6 months in isolation. Country Friends is a story about love, friendship, family, and betrayal. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. Again, it's set in the Hudson Valley. And let's let Gary read from the very beginning of the book here.
The house on the hill was in a tizzy. Workmen's trucks streamed up the long gravel driveway. 2 sets of plumbers from both sides of the river had been summoned to de-winterize the 5 bungalows behind the main house, and they did not care for one another. A broken set of windows in one bungalow had to be replaced post-haste, and a family of field mice had chewed through the electrical cable powering another. The handyman, who did not live on the property, was so overwhelmed by the state of affairs, he retreated to the extensive covered porch to eat a cheese sandwich and long deliberative bites. The mistress of the house, Masha, had lowered the shades in her first floor office to escape the cacophony of modern tools and loud country cursing. At times she would peek out to note the surfaces that would have to be wiped down after the workmen left. Natasha, who liked to go by Nat, her 8-year-old daughter, was upstairs, illuminated by a screen in the darkness of her room, in a lonely public world of her own. The only happy member of the household was Alexander Borisovich Sindorovsky, known as Sasha to his friends. Happy, we should say, with an asterisk. He was agitated as well as excited. A windstorm had brought down the heavy branches of 2 dead trees flanking the driveway, scattering the vast front lawn with their dead white rot. Sindorovsky liked to expound at length upon the entropic nature of his estate, the way all manners of growth was allowed to go its own way, sumacs elbowing out more well-heeled plants, ivy poisoning the perimeter, groundhogs bringing destruction upon the gardens, that the scattering of dead tree limbs made the house on the hill look apocalyptic, the very thing Sindorovsky's guests were coming up to escape. The handyman claimed a bad back and was not handy enough to remove all the tree limbs on his own, and the so-called tree guy had gone missing. Sindorovsky, in his athletic pants and wildly colored dressing gown, had tried to move one of these prehistoric branches himself, but the very first heave made him fear a hernia.
That's terrific.
Sindorovsky is the primary character in this novel, but there are many characters, and as I said before, this is a novel about friends. So, I'm going to launch into our longer chat that Gary and I had in just one moment. I did want to say that when he and I spoke, it was on a very strange and terrible and surreal morning when Ukraine was invaded by Russia. Gary has roots both in Russia, where he, of course, moved to the U.S. from Russia when he was 7, but also in Ukraine. And as you can imagine, he has a lot of feelings about this. I noticed last night he was at a vigil, Free Ukraine vigil, I believe put on by Penn Writers and Artists. Anyway, he and I did speak about that. We had to, of course, and I wanted to hear what he thought, but I've taken that out of the conversation I'm going to play here for you, because I want to focus on the book, and I want to focus on Gary's time up here in the Hudson Valley in the Catskills during the pandemic. So, here it is, me and Gary Steingart speaking.
Now that we've gotten the Russian bear out of the way, maybe we begin with the groundhog on your property? How's the groundhog?
Groundhog's good. His name really is Steve. And my 8-year-old kid loves him. Steve's sightings are always a pleasure. He's, he has no shame. He will attack, I guess Putin style, he will attack everything. Christmas trees, the roots of our favorite plants. He just eats and gobbles. And during the summer, he's unbelievably large. He's like, I take these very long walks around upstate, and I see various kinds of animals, but various kinds of groundhogs, but nobody has kind of almost hourglass figure like this groundhog. He really has been fattening up off of our land. And he has like a summer palace, like in the book, by the pool where he likes to sunbathe. And then he has a kind of winter palace by the trees whose roots he likes to eat on the opposite side of the property. So, you know, when I was writing this book, I went into this kind of weird, I spent most of the, pandemic 1.0 upstate, and I began to notice a lot more than when I kind of went back and forth with the city. I began to notice everything, including even, my friend Fred Savage, the actor, he was interviewing me about this book, and he said, it's the first time I kind of hear silence in your work. I mean, usually there's a lot of frantic kind of activity, very urban, very urbane, but this was, a lot of it was just, a man standing amidst a silent landscape, listening, watching a groundhog scurry around.
Well, I really enjoy how much you do talk about not just the groundhog, but also you mentioned the birds and the turkeys and on in all these different vignettes, and you work them in a really wonderful way as a Catskills animal fan.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many of my friends have left New York even before the pandemic, have moved fairly full time some of them still go down to the city to teach or do things like that, but have moved fairly full time upstate, specifically to the land that we kind of share on both sides of the river. But I didn't expect there to be a whole, this giant exodus that happened in the beginning of the pandemic, where I feel like some people are just reading my book to sort of suss out what it's like to live up here.
I think it would work though for the nascent Catskills Tourism Board.
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, it's wonderful. There's no. I get so much more thoughts in. I'm able to. I don't think I'm even able to work in the city in terms of putting down thoughts for a new book. Right now I'm planning out a new book that is at a very nascent stages, but I know that I'm going to have to spend a month or two. I teach at Columbia during the spring semester, but as soon as that's over, I'm going to hightail it up to the cat, to the region, to really plot out the next book, because I find it so much easier to get thoughts down. The writing too, but I think in general, just those walks, those country walks with, which I do about a 6-mile walk, and it takes about two hours, a little bit longer. But during that time, I can start a walk and come back with a chapter in my mind. And how else can someone do that? But in the city, that would be impossible.
So I'm glad you brought up the walks, because, I have two questions. One is, when you're walking in the country, do you listen to music, or do you wear headphones or listen to anything else?
I do sometimes listen to podcasts. So I kind of alternate. I'll listen to a podcast, listening to, The Daily or something, just to get the basic information down, or, Throughline or one of those kinds of shows. But then I also like to spend some time without anyone talking into my ear, even the dulcet tones of, what's his name? Mike Barbaro. I think it's more important to. It's interesting, when I was promoting Lake Success, and I gave a reading in Tivoli, that beautiful kind of church type space. I guess it's no longer a church, but I gave a reading there, and I mentioned, one day I may like to write a book set up here. And this woman got up. She was in the front room. She was like, "Don't you dare write about us until you spend full time up here." It's like, you half timers have no idea what's going on. And because of the pandemic, I was there full time. So I feel like I checked off my bingo card and hopefully satisfied that woman. I haven't heard a response from her yet, but, you know.
Yeah, there's a real, like, you know, there's the weekender versus the full-timer vibe. And
yeah, and I was never really a weekender. I mean, I spend probably 6 months out of the year there, no question. But, you know, her point was full-time or bust.
Agreed. So when you're walking, so I'm glad you mentioned that you do a little bit of both, and I do the same. Walking is the thing every day that will calm me for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when I wake up with too many things to do, and I just, so walking will immediately take that anxiety away.
Oh, yeah.
Stave it off. But also, it's where all of the problems get worked out in my head. If I'm writing a piece or I'm planning something, and sometimes I do also listen to podcasts, but they also get in the way because then I'm just kind of entertaining myself instead of mm-hmm. in my head.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. You're entertaining yourself. And I feel like, you know, without the walks, I wouldn't have stumbled on, and for example, in the book, there's a abandoned summer camp, children's summer camp, right? And on one of my walks, I actually did stumble upon something like that, and I was absolutely enthralled. And it's like finding the ruin of an ancient civilization, you know, even though I think it was decommissioned only a couple of years ago, but it already felt like that. And, you know, and in the same time, society itself had come to a kind of, not collapse, but certainly to a standstill in some ways because of the pandemic. So being in an abandoned summer camp felt maybe a little too on the nose, but at the same time was just, I just began to chronicle it the way, you know, one chronicled Pompeii after finding it. And that's the interesting thing about upstate is it is, I mean, we have lovely ruins. It's, you know, it goes through so many different phases. Think of, for example, IBM moving into the Kingston and other parts of upstate and then leaving it, you know, GE. I mean, all these different things. It's a very complicated history. It's not like New York, which will always have industries, media, finance, etc. So I find this absolutely fascinating that amongst all this stillness, there's also so much human story.
And I think you're right that, I mean, the right way to describe it is ruins. I also have a resort across the street and up the hill, which took me a couple of years to even stumble across it. And it has been abandoned for 25 years and it has a giant pool and, you know, tumbling in cottages and...
What's the name of the resort?
I think it was called, because there is a sign, I'm going to get it wrong now, the Buena... Anyway, it wasn't one of the famous Catskill resorts, but...
No, too far up for that.
It was a big deal here.
Yeah, because I used to live, and one of the reasons I love upstate so much is that the best parts of my summers when I was a kid were spent upstate at a Russian bungalow colony where, you know, I was always laughed at in school for not speaking English well or wearing a big Russian fur hat or something like that. But in this Russian bungalow colony, all the kids spoke a kind of combination of Russian and English. It felt very warm and welcome, and also it was very beautiful. It was, you know, the Catskills, the stars that come out in the Catskills. I wish our side of the river had the same kind of a display of light. But we were near a hotel called the Tamarack Lodge that we thought was the fanciest hotel ever. I mean, you know, it just come from the Soviet Union. And in Little Failure, I talk about how once my mom and I went, and sort of we were just, you know, we walked in there and we ended up ushered into a dining room and we had we had this meal and you were supposed to be a guest and they gave us a number to fill it and we had, you know, steak and Coca-Cola. It felt like the height of decadence and we just scribbled a made-up number and fled from there. I thought it was very funny. But I know that Tamarack, I think it went out of business and then it kind of fell apart. And so I'm very curious. I'd love to go back there and sort of check it out because to me, this was this like futuristic, super rich place. And now almost a metaphor for sort of American decline, you know. And I think, yeah, there's always these pools that cave in. I was recently, speaking of the headlines, I was a couple years ago in Chernobyl. And I went to visit some of the ruins there. It's also fascinating. And they had this incredibly large pool. I think because people in these little atomic towns were treated very well by the Soviet state. They were given all kinds of privileges. So it was this incredible sports complex, including this very deep, sort of almost Olympic-sized pool. And so ruins of pools are very intriguing to me. I don't know why.
How many years did you come up here as a kid?
I don't know. I want to say 5 or something like that. I mean, it was quite a long time. And again, like I said, the best summers of my life, I think, in some ways. And so when I was writing Our Country Friends, I wanted to replicate the main character Sasha, or one of the main characters, has built himself a kind of very expensive bungalow colony, but 5 little cottages, you know, in which his friends go to hunker down during the first phase of the pandemic. And I don't have 5 cottages, but I definitely have a, you know, guest room and a little guest house. So I do like hosting these kind of fresh air fun type things for my urbanized friends, and we have a really great time and cook out and do all that wonderful stuff.
And you have a beautiful screened-in porch, which mm-hmm. was featured in the Times, which mm. we've been trying to figure out a screened-in structure on our back porch, and yeah. that seemed to be, you seem to have gotten it right. It's a really beautiful porch.
Screened-in porch is very important, both to the book and to my sense of well-being. It's also the place where I write a lot. So, you know, when the weather, there's a stove, but it doesn't really do much, I'll be honest. But, you know, from about May through November, I'm able to, which is my prime writing time, I'm able to go out there and write on the porch. And that is very, 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 very helpful.
Can you talk a little bit about what, so when you're going to do this, this coming, you know, May and through the summer, as you look to your new book, what is that process like as far as just the day to day? How much time you put into it?
Yeah, I mean, it's different. This is the earliest phase. So the earliest phase is not even writing chapters. I mean, it's taking notes on everything. It's reading a lot of books that align with what. So this is going to be, you know, reading on the porch time, and there'll probably be a couple of months of that. And that would entail, I don't know, hours on the porch each day. You know, when I write, I don't write more than 2 or 3 hours. 3 hours is the limit, because it kind of goes downhill after a while. There's only so much you can. You have to put yourself in this mode, you know, of kind of exhilaration almost, and you know, all the endorphins have to start firing. And more than 3 hours of that's too many endorphins. You know, it's. I think maybe that's why writers drink so much, because they need to calm down afterwards. There's no time limit to the research phase. That's you know, I mean, when I was researching, my most research book I think was Lake Success, when I had to figure out finance, and that's very hard, especially for somebody who doesn't understand numbers or logic or anything like that. And I had to surround myself with all these quants who kept talking very fast, and you know, trying to figure out what was what, and talking to a lot of finance journalists and stuff like that. So that was very helpful, but this book, I think, will not entail anything that complicated, but I still need to do a lot of reading.
So I want to do 2 things here. Can I just read you a quick quote? Because mm-hmm. This reminds me of it.
Sure.
So recently, of course, Joan Didion died, and Fresh Air and Terry Gross re-aired a bunch of interviews that they had done with her, which mm-hmm. were quite striking. And in an interview from the 80s, here's what Joan Didion said, and it made me wonder about your characters in Our Country Friends. So mm-hmm. here's what she said. She says, for one thing, when you're writing a novel, you're alienated from the world of other human beings. And then she follows up and says, you just have these imaginary playmates who you spend the day with, and once you're deeply into it, you kind of resent it when you have to go out and go out to dinner and talk to other people, when you find them an intrusion into this imaginary world. It's a peculiar hazard of writing novels.
Yeah, it's funny. I think a lot of writers think that way. I mean, I would say this, that the pandemic in some ways was that kind of intrusion, well, a beneficial intrusion, I would say, because in some ways, I was cut off from the social life, the drinking life, all of that kind of stuff. I was cut off from New York, where a lot of this stuff happens. And I found myself walking down the streets and having conversations with imaginary friends and wishing that I did have friends populating my property. So in my mind, I began to build these extra guest houses and stuff them full of people. And that's sort of, I mean, that's the entire conceit of the book, and that's sort of what I was doing. So, very much so. And there was a kind of glorious sense of loneliness, you know, where you felt apart from people, but you also felt like people are good, you know. In missing people, you began to realize what people bring to the table. I mean, this is my first novel that's really about friendship, because my first few novels, you know, are kind of typical immigrant novels where you're like, what the hell is up with my parents, you know? Or I guess typical any kind of, you know, teenager, early 20s novels, you know. And then there were questions about love, supersensual love stories, very much about a romance. But this one is very much about the subject of friendship, but when it happens to friends when they hit a certain age, you know, about to turn 50, which is true for most of my friends. Some of them have already crossed that Rubicon. And so, you know, you begin to sort of, I mean, this is the stock taking time, and country, tales of the country often involve that, maybe because people retire to the country later, such as myself. But, you know, they are tales of sort of like, you know, Chekhov stories and plays set in the country are just monumental odes or dirges to regrets. You know, oh, I wish I'd done that. Why am I doing this? Shouldn't be a country doctor. You know, or people having achieved what they sought out and like, well, that's not enough. So all of that was on my mind when I was plotting these eight characters and thinking about my friends and their sort of stations in life at this point, especially being, you know, the children of immigrants, which almost all the characters are with a few exceptions in the book, and having these really outsized expectations from their immigrant parents who are like, you know, we brought you here, so you got to perform now.
Well, the immigrant experience is certainly often central to your books, but it really feels like it in Our Country Friends.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because each character is struggling in their own way.
Yeah, everyone's struggling in their own way. And, you know, again, it's, you know, in this book, I sort of took the parents out. There aren't a lot of scenes with parents, very few. It's mostly just them interacting, which is very different from previous books where the parents figure quite prominently. You know, I think at this point in life, we've internalized the parents, so there's not a need for the parents to even be present on the page. It's figuring out how much of them you've internalized, and then how much you can pass on the good parts of them to, if you have any children, and the two proprietors of this estate, Sasha and Masha, have a daughter named Natasha, you know, so they're thinking about that, and Masha's a psychiatrist, so she obviously thinks about these things quite a bit, but figuring out what parts of yourself best to pass on to the next generation.
So when the pandemic hit, obviously this book was born out of you spending more time up here, but did you find that that the actual experience of writing was faster and quicker, or was the pace picked up because of the pandemic, or maybe was it the opposite?
Oh, yeah, 6 months. 6 months it took. And you know, I love my editor, David Ebershoff. This was the lightest editing he'd ever done. Because really, I was very much wrapped up in this. I mean, the pandemic kind of provided the perfect background for doing something, because it was not just the joy to do it, but also, like I was saying, it was a convocation of friends in my own mind. You know, it was really wonderful. I couldn't wait to get to the computer.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
I know. When do writers say that, right? Usually it's like, I always counsel, you know, when I teach creative writing at Columbia, I always counsel that, you know, this isn't always going to be fun. And in fact, if you're a little too comfortable, you're maybe not, you know, making your way into uncomfortable territory, which means you're not doing your real job as a writer. But in this case, it really was a kind of a wonderful place to meet people who were no longer near me.
So you're a terrifically funny writer.
Thank you.
And so, but as somebody who loves reading a novel like our country friends, which is a little bit absurd, or at least some of the characters, of course, are absurd, right? Sarandowski is off the charts in all the best ways.
Yeah.
I can see his robe flapping in the wind, and it's really tremendous. But so once you get it down and you come back to it a bit and start editing, how do you, and maybe this isn't what you do, but in my mind, I wonder, how do you know when there's enough funny on the page with a character or with the plot or however with the story? Is it about rhythm or scanning a page, or is it?
I think rhythm is a good way to look at it. Like, in a sense, when you're being funny, you're also buying the reader's attention so that you can get to less funny stuff, you know, because I'm always there to entertain. I don't like to read books that don't entertain me on some level. Funny is usually my gold standard, but doesn't quite have to be. I do love to just smile. And that smile buys me the opportunity to talk about really tragic things. You know, I mean, there's tragic things do happen in our country, friends. It's obviously a pandemic novel. You know, I'm not going to, it can't all be fun and games, but the central relationships between all the different characters, there's, you know, there's so many love triangles in this thing too, and sex and food and all that. But that's all presented in as funny a way as I can, you know, which I've done in all my work, you know, that dealt with subjects like romance and, but done it in kind of, you know, to me, the humor is sort of, people don't quite know who they are. You know, you may think you're a giraffe, but you're actually an aardvark or a groundhog or something, you know. And that's that distance between who people think they are and who they really are is fascinating, you know. And very funny.
I'm sorry, and what?
And very funny.
Yeah, and I think one of the keys maybe to that, at least for you, or from my perspective, is that you're incredibly honest. And now I'm thinking a little bit about your memoir, Little Failure. You're incredibly honest about yourself, and it probably helps to make it, it's easier to be funny sometimes when you're thinking back than it is to be mad, maybe.
Well, you know, I mean, when you're younger, I think you're more satiric because anger is still anger at how you were brought up, anger at the world you were brought up, all that stuff is very understandable. Even more understandable, I think, for the next generation of writers, such as the ones I teach at Columbia, because of the not so great world that our generations have handed down to them, an ever more problematic world. I think as I grow older, and I think as other writers grow older, some of that feeling is still there, but is more balanced with a kind of more elegiac approach, which is, I think, yeah, again, bringing him up, more Chekhovian in tone, maybe, than, say, someone like Gogol, who, you know, wrote the great Dead Souls, the great satire of Russia, which is every bit as true in 2022 as it was when he wrote it in the 19th century. So, you know, to me, that's sort of, that maybe if I'm to talk about evolution, it's that. And especially when you think about this book, which has, yeah, there is a kind of undertone of despair, but at the same time, I don't really take any of my characters apart the way I think I did. I'm not as cruel to them as I was before, maybe because after all these years, I mean, there are psychopaths like Putin out there and Trump, but I think for the most part, people have just the usual combination of good, not so good, banal, all that kind of stuff. And especially among some of the people I'm looking at in this book, many of whom are kind of upper middle class and self-satisfied.
Self-satisfied is great. I like that. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you one last question about, again, because I was listening to Little Failure. You talk about in there the dacha and the importance of that with your own family and mm-hmm. the time that you spent in the summers in different places across Russia and Ukraine. And you have this wonderful quote where you say to your mother, dacha might as well have meant the loving grace of God.
It's true. I mean, it's very interesting because in so many ways I thought of myself as a city person. My first books chronicle life in big centers like New York, Prague, a little bit of Rome. You know, I think about cities quite a bit. But maybe at heart, I really am a country boy. Maybe at heart, I've always wanted this. This has always been the place where I would kind of end up. I mean, I don't see myself retiring anywhere but in the country, probably the same country that I cover in Our Country Friends. I don't know what that is, and maybe it's because, you know, the country is not just where I write the best, but also where I read the best, where I learn to fall in love with literature the most without the distractions of other things. Sitting on the porch in this ramshackle Russian bungalow colony in Ellenville, reading my first classics, I mean, that was as formative to my career as anything. So, you know, God bless the country. I really will spend however many years I'm given, you know, beneath that beautiful sun, that unencumbered sun. Hopefully the stars will come out. Maybe I'll have a martini or two and enjoy both my friends and all the books I haven't read yet.
The highly entertaining Gary Steingart. His book is called Our Country Friends. Go to your favorite library. Maybe that's in Hudson or Cairo. Wherever it is, go to your favorite library and ask for it by name. That's how you get the books. You go to the library. And I did want to mention, Gary and I talked for a little bit longer, and he shared with me his recipe for a wet martini, which I would highly recommend. And if you'd like that recipe, just go to justinmamon.com and subscribe to the Ginger newsletter. Ginger newsletter comes out every Monday, and it's kind of where this radio show was born from. So I think I have the perfect music coming out of Gary's conversation. Some prints.
Love you in New York. All the bridges love you. All the Tomorrow, call me up, run to you. bread. You make me wanna testify.
Good Friends. That's Wawa Watson. And before that, of course, Prince, with All the Critics Love You in New York. It occurred to me that a nice way to end this show today, the Ginger Radio Hour, thank you for being here, would be to take a walk. So the other day I went for a walk in Purling in the snow, and here's a bit of what that sounded like. And you can just imagine all the creativity that was bursting in my head, I guess. Have a great week. See you in 2 Tuesdays.